3:40 California time, 6:40 Eastern. Steve Caruso will take over at that time for another 20 minutes of schmoozing, and but that part won't be recorded. So we're ready to rock and roll. This is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman. This is the 42nd, count them, 42nd Zoom call, Great Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition Zoom call. I want to welcome all my listeners at the Progressive Radio Network, the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We have been podcasting these Zoom calls. We get quite a few people actually to download it. We go for an hour and a half. So if you get cut off at the top of the hour, the show at PRN runs 5 to 6 Eastern time on Thursday. And if you're listening and you get cut off at the top of the hour, go to grassrootsep.org and to the upcoming Zoom and dig out the link and join and you can listen. It'll be recorded there. So we welcome all you radio listeners. We welcome everybody here. We're up to 60 people. And it's a devastatingly important call today. We have the great Ray McClendon back with us and Joel Siegel. We also have some John Brakey, who's going to fill us in on what we call in Arizona the Michigas, about incredible fight going over the ballots from the previous election. There will be lawsuits, as they say, and John, you'll fill us in on that. I did ask Art Levine to bring us some folks to talk about D.C. statehood. If anybody wants to talk about D.C. statehood, who's involved with that movement, let me know in the chat or raise your hand, and we will get to you. But we do want, I've been promising a discussion on D.C. statehood for a long time, and I hope that people have come on. I have a particular interest. My sister, nieces, and nephews live in D.C., and I would like them actually to become American citizens. What a concept. But we're going to start again with the great Ray McClendon, working with Joel Siegel. Ray, we understand there may be a vote today or tomorrow on HR1, the mega vote on voter rights. And I will say also, Mal, I see you've got your hand up, but let me get to you in a minute. I see that, in our overview, these 2 years between 2021 and 22 will determine the future of this country based on how we can protect the vote and what we can do about gerrymandering the Electoral College, the Voting Rights Act, and all that. And Ray, at the Atlanta NAACP, you are right in the vanguard, and you were one of the key players in the Georgia Miracle, along with Christian Nunez, who's with us from now, and Joel and so many others that really flipped this Congress. And now we're looking at the nitty gritty here. So if you can fill us in on what's going to happen here with HR1, literally in the next couple of days, and what our big strategy is, that would be great.
Well, the first thing I want to do before we get to HR1 is to tell you from a grassroots level why it's so important. We have had protesters at the Georgia State Capitol for the last week and a half protesting omnibus voter suppression bills in both the House and the Senate of Georgia. The Senate has SB 241, which is in the Senate Ethics Committee now. The House passed today HB 541, which is worse than the Senate bill and has a whole host of voter suppression methodologies and strategies that harken back to Jim Crow, and I won't go into all of them, but suffice it to say that the battle is not over. Although it passed, we're going to continue to fight it in the Senate. It passed along party lines, but I'm trying to get the final vote tabulations now. It passed 97-72. So it appears we did crack through with some folks. But the point is, as long as we are facing a total a regime of Republican governors, state House and state Senate Republican majorities, we're going to continue to have these fights across the country. And that is why HR 1 is so important. So I would just implore, every bill can always be improved, but right now we don't have the time to let this bill get bogged down in amendments and strategies. We need to pass HR 1 with the main provisions that it has now that will supersede the kind of voter suppression tactics, taking away our voices, putting more onerous provisions on democracy, which then will, of course, frustrate a lot of people and take them out of the voting process. This is an age-old strategy for 100 years in states like Georgia. They're bringing them back in Jim Crow 2.0, and that's why we need HR 1 to pass now, otherwise we're going to have a calamity in 2022. So I would encourage those who are looking at a lot of different components of this. I'm looking at this as being half full as opposed to half empty, more than half full from our standpoint, because we're in battles at the state level that we cannot win as long as we're fighting Republican governors, House members, and Senate members. And we're gonna be faced with this around the country. We gotta pass HR 1 now.
So where do we stand with HR 1? What is the status of, now HR 1, of course, being the omnibus voting rights bill in the House, where do we stand with it?
Well, I know it's getting close to a vote. I don't have the up to the minute details. Anybody else can speak on that, but I know they're bringing it now to come up for a vote. Again, we have people who have been delivering signatures. We've been calling congressmen and women for the last week. There have been several campaigns to both send emails and also text messages and call-ins to different congressional offices. So I know it's imminent, but I don't know exactly when it is. There might be someone on the call that knows the exact day on when they expect it to be voted on.
Joel Siegel, and then we'll go to Myla, Lulu, and Ruth.
Yeah, so is it now, you want me to just talk about HR 1, but we also want to talk about the campaign, the Save Our Democracy.
All right, let me jump in with the hands, and then we'll come to you, Joel. Ray, thanks for that. Stay with us, please. We also want to get the detail of what these bills are that are in the Georgia legislature, because we know we're going to see them all over the country. This stuff is coming from Alec, you know, the Koch brothers stuff and all that. So you're in the vanguard once again in Georgia. Let me get to Myla, and then Lulu, and then Ruth, and then Emily.
Just real quick, and it's so good to see you, Ray. Thank you for coming back. I just wanted to say, someone mentioned that there are some voting rights or voting integrity issues on the docket at the Supreme Court level. So I did a quick search and I found an article showing explaining what those cases are. That's it. That's all I had to say. So I just put the link in the chat again.
Okay. God help us every time this Supreme Court takes up a case on voting rights, but you know, we'll follow it. Thank you, Myla. Lulu?
Thank you, Harvey. Thanks for having this call. It's always very useful. Smart Elections now has a position paper on HR 1S1, where we're in full support of the bill. We think it's a visionary, once in a generation bill that has some really could make some tremendous necessary changes if it gets passed. But we do have specific concerns. In particular, there's one line that we're worried could be interpreted to mandate that every jurisdiction in the country buy a hybrid voting machine, which is something that we don't want. We're fighting the hybrid voting machines. So one of the election security experts we work with contacted me last week, and we have a position paper. I put the link in the chat. People can read that to find out more about the specific line that we're concerned about and a few of our other concerns that we've been talking about, like the issues that Howie Hawkins has brought up about third party candidates really getting the short stick. So that link is in the chat, and we encourage your organization to sign on. I put also a Google form in the chat if you want to sign on to the letter. And then the other, I have a question for Ray, if you would. Ray, this is something that I had not heard about, and I'm wondering if you could weigh in on this. I had a meeting today with one of our collaborators from the NAACP. She said that the NAACP is not supporting the ranked choice voting provision of the bill, not nationally and not locally, and that they are very, very concerned that ranked choice voting is not going to help Black and Brown communities. And I really want to hear, this is the first time I've heard this, I'm really interested in your input. Is that your impression, and what can we do about that?
I haven't focused on that. Let me do some more research to find out what the position of national is. And I'll follow back up with you. I'll try to find that before the meeting's over. But again, this is the kind of thing that we cannot allow ourselves to get too far down in the weeds and let these great provisions that could make a difference get bogged down and not pass because of some individual components that we have that we don't like.
Absolutely. We are fully 100% behind the bill. We really think it's an important and necessary bill, and I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you for all your work on it.
Thank you.
Okay, great. And Lulu, we'll expect we have, I mentioned earlier, we also Jennifer Tanner has joined. We are setting up a calendar at the website. I know you run a weekly Zoom. And Jennifer, if you are going to go weekly with yours, you can post the time and the Zoom link and your own link to your website on the calendar that Steve Caruso is setting up on our website. So we're happy to have you on there. Ruth Strauss and then Emily Levy. Ruth?
Yeah, this could go to Lulu or Ray or anyone else. There are, as has been alluded to, there are some problems with the bill. I'm glad to take the leadership of Ray and Lulu and people who say we should all be behind it. I know there were some problems with it, and there's even an ACLU paper on problems with it. But my only question is, if anybody knows, once it, you know, we get behind it and if it is passed, is it then able to be amended in any way? Or if we have concerns, are there ways that we can pick out parts of it to amend or change or whatever once it's passed?
Ray or Lulu? Ray, do you know about that?
You know, again, I'm nervous about that. I'd love to be able to say yes. If we had a stronger majority in the Senate, maybe that would be possible. But we're barely going to be able to get across the finish line in the House, and it's going to be an even more uphill struggle in the Senate because of the razor thin margin we have. I think the challenge is we need to pass what we can now, be behind it 100% as Lulu has decided, and then try to clean it up after it is law, to try to amend it and accept amendments from the floor. If that's what you're referring to, I don't see that as anything.
No, I meant at a later date. I agree that right now it has to be passed.
At a later date, absolutely. But I think we got to move on this. Joel, you want to weigh in on that? You've worked in the House.
Yeah, so when it goes to the Senate, that would be where there could be possibly some changes. There would have to be direct connect to the staffer and the member that is going to do that. I mean, actually, even in its current form, you know, the concern is the filibuster. And will we have to use budget reconciliation? So just to get it through in its current form, it's going to be very challenging. If they did take out the $15 minimum, I'm sorry, start thinking about COVID-19 relief bill. Is I'm very worried about it passing in the Senate. What I'm worried about is the Senate actually taking out the more progressive House language. That's what I'm really concerned about, because that's usually the history of the Senate. They're a lot more conservative, and you got Jim Manchin there, and this the senator from Arizona whose name is leaving me right now.
Kyrsten Sinema.
Made an impression on me. If we can just get this passed in its current form, it's going to be amazing. I spoke to a senior level Judiciary Committee staffer who I used to work with, and the concern will be post-Senate vote. So let's say we get it passed in the Senate. The question becomes, I don't want to say this to bum everybody out, but this is the reality, is the Republican attorney generals across the country, they're going to sue, and it's going to end up in the Supreme Court. So they're trying to make HR 1 litigation proof, which is very hard to do. And we're going to have to be prepared to have a discussion about how do you deal with these very conservative people who wear these robes, you know? And we haven't had a Supreme Court strategy, and we're going to need one. I've heard too many people say there's nothing we can do about the Supreme Court. That's not true. There's a lot we can do about the Supreme Court. We just haven't had that discussion. Before Representative Conyers passed away, we had a long conversation. He warned me about the power of the Supreme Court. He said it was the most radical to the right Supreme Court he'd ever seen. They had way too much power. In terms of any kind of amendments, I would say it is possible. Never count out the possibility of changing something. That's a discussion that we'd have to have at some point.
Well, let's go to Emily. And Howie, Steve, and Dorothy. Emily?
So without repeating a lot of what's been said, similarly in scrutineers, there's things that we think are fantastic about the bill, and I think mostly members really strongly support it, and there's concerns that we have. We're working with NVRTF, the National Voting Rights Task Force, and they actually are putting together a statement that's a few amendments that we want to suggest that will be ready by Wednesday, and I hope it's not too late. What we're asking right now is for people who want to consider signing on to that, and I know you'll need to read it first, to just give us your contact information on this form that I'm putting it's a Google form, I'm putting the link into the chat, and that just gives us your contact information so we know to send it to you when it's ready and you can look at it and see if you want to sign on. And then the other thing that we're doing is that Joel Siegel is going to be doing a training in scrutineers tomorrow about how to be effective at advocating for what we want in Congress. And anybody is welcome. Many people here are already members of scrutineers. If you're not, you can just go to scrutineers.org and join, and then you can come to that training tomorrow, which is at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific time for 90 minutes. And I really, really appreciate, Joel, your willingness to do this. He's got so much knowledge and experience, and I think it's going to be a fantastic resource. If you can't attend live, it will be available inside our membership site recorded afterwards.
Thank you, Emily.
All right, great. Thank you, Emily. And thank you, Joel, for doing that. Harry Hawkins?
Yeah, I want to go back to that question of ranked choice voting in the election of people of color. If the NAACP has taken that position, they're going against all the evidence. The first Black city councilor was Adam Clayton Powell Jr., elected under a ranked choice voting, New York City, 1939, under a third party, the American Labor Party. There are 38 cities now with ranked choice voting. The representation of people of color has basically doubled. If you go over the history of those cities, most of which are recent. And I think where the resistance is coming from is that incumbent Black politicians don't want Black competition. Because in ranked choice voting, if you're a voter, you want a Black representative, you can rank your Black candidates in order of preference. The incumbents don't want competition. That's where that's coming from. We've seen that in New York City with these primaries with ranked choice voting. So. Mm-hmm. Ranked choice voting enhances the ability of people of color and women, political minorities, to get representation.
Okay. Ray, you want to speak to that, or should we move on?
Let's move on.
Okay. Thank you, Howie. Thank you for that. Steve?
Question for Ray about, once again, Daniel Blackman and what's going on with that. I contacted, took the liberties of contacting Brakey's lawyer, Chris Souter, and he says there's no stipulation against questioning the election results if there was an error in the process where he was not available on ballots in 38 counties. Now, he said he needed legal representation. I don't know if there's been any movement on that, but I think we need to still look at that personally. I don't know if anybody can help with that. Thank you.
Well, as I mentioned on last week's call, he texted me back while we were on the call, and he indicated that he didn't have the legal resources to move forward, and the party was not willing to put resources behind them, and the state party in Georgia. So it essentially was dead in the water. So unless someone's looking to revive the campaign with real resources behind it, I don't think it's going anywhere.
Okay.
All right, that's a shame. Dorothy Reich? Dorothy, you with us? You muted?
Yeah. So okay. I have to second what Joel has been saying. My fear is that pass a law, even if it passes the Senate, it's gonna, all these laws are gonna be challenged by like the Attorney General of Texas. It's gonna get thrown up to the Supreme Court, and every single law that we make is gonna be called unconstitutional. We have got to start working on fixing that Supreme Court. We have to add people. We have to do whatever desperate thing we need to do, because we are in desperate trouble with this Supreme Court. I can't even begin to say how frightened I am about this. And the other thing is, I talked to Jennifer Tanner and I talked to Alan Minsky, and we need to concentrate on getting constituents in West Virginia and in Arizona to start calling Manchin and Sinema and not give them any peace at all. It has to be relentless all day, every day, letters, emails, faxes, everything, but it has to come from constituents. If it comes from people out of their state, they don't care. They only want their voters. They have to know their voters are going to vote them out if they don't vote to end the filibuster. But ending the filibuster is only part one. We still have to deal with the Supreme Court. And Biden seems to be totally oblivious to this. Everybody seems to be oblivious. There's no point passing laws when the Supreme Court can call them unconstitutional. Shouldn't be able to do that. Wasn't in the Constitution for them to be able to reject laws, but they've done it, and now it's part of the wallpaper. And I don't know what we're going to do about it.
We got some mountains to climb. There's no doubt about that. Laura Chamberlain, you wanted to jump in on this. Thank you, Dorothy. Laura.
Hi. Yeah. Yep. And so I'm going to, Lulu, thank you so much for your paper. We'll look at that.
Laura, you just went mute on us. Laura Chamberlain, I will come back to you.
Hi,
Laura?
Hi, back.
All right,
yep,
okay.
Back. Don't know how that happened. Didn't touch my phone. Okay, so we are sitting with Wyden's office, Ron Wyden's office, about HR 1 tomorrow. And we want to get a sense of the Senate and what they're really thinking about this, how they're going to move this bill. And we also are in approval of most of this bill, but we do think that there needs to be some amendments. We do. And so we're very concerned about the aspects that Lulu talked about. And there are a couple other amendments. And we came to a conclusion with the people that were coming on the HR1 call of at least five areas of priorities. And I sent it around on the listserv. And so we're going to get a sense of it. So I'll be posting on the listserv after our meeting to let everybody know what Ron Wyden's office, who is really one of our champions in the Senate, what they say about how they think this bill is going to be passed, whether or not amendments will be encouraged or even or blocked by the Democratic leadership and, you know, where they're going with it. Cool.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you for that, Laura. Justin, Ruth, and then Art Levine has joined us. Art, it's good to see you. We do want to talk about DC statehood later in the call, and we'll get to you then. Justin and then Ruth.
Hello. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, please.
Great. So Joel mentioned something about a legal strategy in front of the Supreme Court on how to protect voter rights. I think the major thing here is we shouldn't ever allow the state to usurp poll workers and their right to judge people's credentials. Really, when it's your neighbor who sees you, they know you're legit. So what's, you know, give the power to them and also give them the power to count and get some videotaping in there so that we can actually have some real observation of elections and we can prove to everything everybody's legitimate. So
is that, is that in the HR 1 bill?
Unfortunately, not really. So this would probably be something that would have to go through the courts. Dr. Laura has mentioned that they've tried for about 10 years to get something similar, but it's Ray Lutz who actually has made, I think, the most substantive progress along with John Brakey on these kinds of things.
Ray, has that come up in Georgia at all, the question of poll workers and their ability to monitor the votes?
And the credentials for and against credentials. Voter suppression.
Okay, well, let me tell you. Okay, so, and I hate to use the fight analogy, but you got to understand there's a difference when you're playing at the 30,000 foot view, and you can take this theoretically, versus we are here on the ground and, you know, we're in a gunfight with, you know, with knives, and we're losing every day, and we're trying not to lose heart. These bills are draconian. We've gone through some of this, so I'm repeating myself for many of you, but the bill that passed today will require two photocopies of ID. It will limit mobile voting sites. Who does that hurt the most? Black and brown people, because we always have the lowest number of voting machines. Many times the people are undertrained. The infrastructure is not as good, and therefore some of the larger counties like Fulton County, where we are in Atlanta, they came up with this ingenious idea to have mobile voting. So they have buses that literally will go to a site and that is having challenges. And that was very effective. Some of you may recall that the primary in Georgia was a disaster. And it was primarily in neighborhoods of color. The lines were long, and they had machines breaking down. They had people that were not trained. Mobile voting really helped in that when that came into existence for November. They are dramatically limiting that for our communities. It is also limiting the number of voting booths. It's cutting down the time for you to request an absentee ballot from 11 weeks, which gives people more than adequate time, with the U.S. Postal Service being systematically dismantled by DeJoy. We needed that 11 weeks, and now it's down to no later than two Fridays before the election. It will outlaw Sunday voting. Outlaw Sunday voting. It will also cut down the time frame for when absentee ballots will be sent out from 45 days down to 25 days. Again, that's bringing the Postal Service into play once again. No government can voluntarily send out absentee ballots, as some governmental entities did last year. And moreover, third parties can't send out absentee ballot requests. Early voting locations will only be in government buildings, and drop boxes will only be available in those same government buildings during the time that early voting is available, and will possibly have law enforcement guarding the drop boxes, which will be a deterrent to people in communities of color to use the drop boxes. Okay, we know that voter purging is going to be an issue next year, because that's the playbook that then Secretary of State Kemp used in his own race in order to ensure his victory, where he purged over 330,000 voters, disproportionately Black and Brown voters, in 2018, and he won over Stacey Abrams by 55,000 votes. So the point here is, and now they're going using the big lie to with all of that we overcame. With all of that we overcame, and now we're back at a point where they want to ensure that they have moved the goalposts. I want to say they haven't just moved the goalposts, they're in a whole new stadium now. So we got to do things today at the federal level. Otherwise, you can potentially kiss the Warnock seat in 2022 goodbye if we don't fix this now. And I don't know what other seats potentially you're looking to pick up in order to broaden the progressive majority in the Senate. You're going to lose because other state legislatures are doing the exact same thing. And we'll have this in place for 2022.
Unbelievable. I'm going to take two more calls, then we go to John Brakey to explain to us what's going on in Arizona. That'll be part of the discussion, Harvey, because unfortunately it's paralleling in Arizona what's going on in Georgia.
Hey, Harvey?
Who wanted to speak?
I was supposed to speak after Ray, very briefly.
Okay. Ruth and then Lynn.
Oh, I was just going to say, I sent this already into Ray, but I just decided maybe I would announce it. I would wonder whether the ACLU would have some reason to take up this case with Dan Blackmon. My nephew works at a law firm that does a lot of national pro bono work, like the migrant children reunited. So I'm going to talk with him, and I think everybody, you know, hopefully we'll help Ray out and, you know, network with whomever you can. Maybe we can get people to do that case for pro bono.
That'd be great.
That would be great. Thanks.
Thank you, Ruth. That's a big one. We appreciate that. Lynn, and then we'll go to John Brakey in Arizona. I want to welcome Charlie Cray onto the call from Greenpeace. Charlie, it's great to have a Rainbow Warrior back on with us, and I hope Greenpeace is going to continue with the election protection work. Lynn Feinerman, and then we'll go to John in Arizona.
Okay. Ray, can you give us something really practical to do, like, you know, massively calling senators in Georgia or something? I mean, is there something that we on a nationwide basis can do and promote for others to do to make sure that this crappy bill doesn't pass in Georgia?
Yeah, the thing that you can do is the Center for Common Ground. I don't know if Elsa's on today, but the Center for Common Ground has a phone banking platform where they have set up the ability to call in. We talked about it a little bit last week. So you all can use that phone bank and call Georgia voters, and then connect those Georgia voters in either via text or via phone to their specific state senator's office to voice their concerns. And that would be a big help to have people using phone banks and text banking to do that.
Great. I want to note that Eileen Proctor is on the call. Eileen is our great PR person on the left who gets us in the media. And also Christian Nunez from NOW, the National Organization for Women. Maybe this kind of network can be fit into your great organization, Christian. And if you have anything you wanna say real quick, pop in. And then we'll go to John Brakey there in Arizona. John, I don't think we could make up what's going on in Arizona there. I mean, it's mind boggling. There's 77 people on the call. I think you're representing Arizona. So tell us about the lawsuits and this attempt to get a hold of the ballots and what the Republicans are doing.
Well, it's exciting. It's you know, what it's hard to believe that we're in March and elections are still big on the agenda. You know, there are several lawsuits going on. We even filed a lawsuit a couple of weeks ago. That was because they blocked the parties from coming in and working with these two vendors that they hired, who, well, really, they hired the people who certified the software for Dominion to come in and actually do the audit. And so that, to me, was conflictive. They blocked the parties. Mainly, they were blocking me from coming in, really, because the other two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, usually don't have people who are very serious about doing elections. They just come in and observe and go, ooh, and so they replaced us with the League of Women Voters. We've been in court twice. The 16th, we wrapped that up. They're trying to say the case is moot. Of course, it's not, because if they do this every time and they run out of time, so we still have an active case to fix Arizona law. But the big thing that's happening right now is the claim of stolen elections, as you see on the screen. There's all sorts of stuff. You know, I refer to these Republicans as my brothers and sisters because I have two brothers and a sister who are with them in other states. And these, a lot of these people are looking really to find out if elections are real. That I think for some of them, or a lot of them, it's like being down a rabbit hole and you don't know what's real or not. And I've turned in somewhat of a guide to help them. So anyway, with that being said, the ballots are in 1,400 boxes. If you wanted to put one precinct together, you would probably have to open up 1,350 boxes, okay? We're talking the second largest voting district in the United States. There's 2.1 million ballots at stake. I don't want them opening the ballots up or these boxes. I want the ballots to stay secure for right now. We want to work the ballot images, because, you know, the ballot images are really going to be the telltale that's going to tell us, you know, what's going on, because we can sort those 2,001 ballot images into precincts. Ray Lutz and Clear Ballot, companies like that, can rerun them and give us the results to see. And if everything adds up perfect, then we want to go back into those boxes and we want to go ahead and one by one match images up to the ballots to prove that they're real or not and get that handled. Now, last week, the Senate, there was a court case on Thursday. Ours was on Wednesday. Theirs was on Thursday. The judge ruled Friday morning, and he is giving them complete access to everything in our Constitution in the state. The Senate has subpoena power, and they're taking hold of that power. I'm advising them to be very careful, because if you go after the ballots at first and you start messing up the order, this is a federal election, the feds could come in and take them. I've seen this happen. It happened in 2004 on a small election where there was only 20,000 ballots involved. One guy won by 4 votes. They had a recount by machine. The next machine count, they won by 14. What's crazy, in those 20,000 votes, they found 489 new votes. So it's going to be a very sensitive subject. And we want to keep the order, because the original ballots are the most important ballot. Then comes the ballot image. Then comes the cast vote record.
John, to clarify, are they trying to go back and recount the presidential vote in Arizona?
Yes. Absolutely. Really?
They're going back to recount the ballots?
I hate to be sympathetic to them, but, you know, skepticism is destroying our country, okay? And, you know, people need to know if they really won or lost. And these ballot images are the key to be able to prove that. You know, if Ray Lutz gets them, he will run them, and then he will send them back in 743 precincts. They'll average somewhere around 2,500 ballots each. Let people count. And then when they get done counting, let's match some of those images to the ballot. Let's prove that if elections are real or not. Because if not voting in this country was a presidential candidate, even in the last election, they might have won by a landslide. The point is that we have to work on building voter confidence by proving that elections are real. Voting is a secret process. Counting is the public. Somehow we've lost our way.
All right. So, let me ask you also, Arizona, the Arizona legislature, my understanding, it has been considering a bill that would allow the legislature to override the popular vote and pick the Electoral College delegates, no matter how the public votes. Is that still happening?
You know, there's a lot of talk of a lot of bills. You know, fortunately, our Senate is 16-14, 16 Republicans. If one just comes over, it's done, okay, in the Senate. The House is 32-28, very close. And Governor Ducey's being recalled. Hey, listen, I live in the recall state where Republicans are breaking the 11th commandment of Reagan, and they're recalling fellow Republicans, and it's open warfare going on, okay?
And well, we have it in California.
Now these recalls happen, it's only gonna give the Democrat the win, because if a recall election happens, you'll have two Republicans running each other and a Democrat will get in.
Okay, so, but this bill that has everybody terrified, where the state legislature wants to say that they can intervene and choose the Electoral College delegation. And if it goes to the US Supreme Court, this Supreme Court will probably uphold that. Because
I don't think our Supreme Court will, and I don't think our governor will. But yeah, we should all be nervous about this kind of stuff. You know, what's really happening is that the Republicans, you know, are learning about election fraud like we learned 2004, but they keep saying voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud. And I keep telling them, you know, hey, that's Orwellian language, you know, stop blaming the voters. God damn it. Let's talk about what's really going on in this country and what we can do to bring confidence back into the system.
Okay. Art Levine, you have a question, which I can't quite decipher. Art?
Yeah. Well, basically, my question is this: at this very moment, with voting rights in peril, for now and in the future, is it a good idea to be raising election integrity questions and ask for a long shot reform on ballot imaging and so on, because a lot of your talking points can be seized on by GOP actors with bad faith who are going to seize on these critiques, well, the machines are problematic, and then turn them into, you know, general talking points to help on their vote suppression agenda. What are you going to be doing to not muddy the message, you and other election integrity activists? So if you focus on the machine risks, like I did in my article that published last September, you are at risk of allowing those talking points to be used by the GOP to help stop voting rights. Please address.
Well, I think that, you know, you always have to be concerned. But, you know, building relationships and communicating with people and trying to get them to think like Americans about this problem is a lot better. And that's what I'm trying to do. Sometimes I'm wondering if I'm back in a therapeutic community running therapy 40 years ago or what's going on.
Okay.
It's difficult. Building relationships is important.
Yeah, but building a you know, relationship to convince the GOP that really do want to stop voters from voting, that voting machines are really a big problem that still need to be fixed by your method of ballot images, is assuming their good faith. I'm going to post again my Medium article looking at the expert monitors on conspiracy thinking and others. You need to understand this is not like it was 20 years ago, where you could make a policy point to people of good faith. Go see the Netflix film Social Dilemma. The point of it is, and I just heard the lead guy of that, is this is a weaponized use of social media that he likens to a nuclear bomb on people's internal psychology. It's already been done, and there's been this weaponization, and they're in there's no shared reality at this moment in time in our republic. And therefore, arguments on a rational level about ballot images that can be exploited and seized on to help make the case for whatever Arizona is doing, in the same way that something that that Brad said 15 years ago about Hugo Chavez and Smartmatic became part of the conspiracy theories. I'm just saying that you are at great risk of making whatever talking points you are making right now in a lawsuit and through advocacy on voting machine reform, undercutting the much more urgent thing of these states moving forward under the myth of voter fraud accepted by 80% of all Republicans in the country, okay? Fully believe it. And so based on that and what their base is doing and what we saw in Florida with the worship of Trump, you are at risk of having this stuff seized on and used against people's rights to voting. Please keep that in mind.
I'm not driving this train.
No, okay, but
I'm not playing the
track. I'm not saying you're driving.
I'm out there trying to educate people. Okay. That's my not point. Getting them educated is not a decision. You have to help these people understand that maybe they're being manipulated by the man in an orange face, okay? And the only way you're going to do that when it comes to an authoritarian leader claiming that our elections are stolen is to prove to the people that it wasn't. Just the media walking away and making believe it's not true or not wanting to address it and just call them wing nuts or whatever is not a good situation. This is an opportunity to help people understand.
Okay. All right. Then,
thank you for the question.
Julie Wiener. Julie, you have a hand?
Yeah, I'd like to say two things. Number one, I found the link to the phone bank for Georgia voters. So I want to say it out loud so people who are listening can hear it. It's www.votinginformation.org/GA phone bank, all one word, GA phone bank. And
You want to put that
voting information.org/GA phone bank so people can join to recruit Georgia voter to get Georgia voters to make phone calls against these draconian bills.
Okay.
And then my second point is that it's very interesting. There was an answer to a question at the CPAC by an attorney stating that it's not true that voting machines threw thousands of votes. So apparently the Republican Party is also now backing off of their attempted critique of Dominion, I could speculate, in order to defend the SNS voting machines. Perhaps.
Well, of course, Dominion also sued them for $2.5 billion.
Yeah. So they're now saying it's not true. Yeah, that's true too. Yeah.
And I think we're going to prove that in Arizona with Maricopa, because I do believe that they're one of the best election departments in the United States. They are Dominion. They are hand-marked paper ballots. The ballots and the ballot images are married to each other. And I think it would be a good thing to let the nation see how a good auditable system would work using ballot images. And that's what I'm betting on.
Okay. All right. Very good. Ray, thank you, Julie.
Thank you, everybody.
So I'd like to speak to the same issue because I think we need to not be afraid of the facts. I think that we want to get the evidence out and what the facts are about the elections, because this is what's harming us, is that there's a lot of beliefs rolling around. Well, I believe this and that. We have to realize that these elections do have a stake in the ground, which is called evidence and facts and reality. And we don't want to be afraid of that. We've got to move forward and say, look, let's look at the evidence. Let's find out and show what happened here. And then sure, there's going to be somebody that says, look, I don't believe the audit. You know, I don't believe that you guys did the audit right. There's no chance of helping those people that aren't going to look. But least we need to be able to move forward and get the facts out. And not say, oh, well, I'm afraid the facts might stir someone up, and therefore we're afraid of getting to the facts. I disagree with that. So I disagree with you, Arthur, about Art Levine, about oh, well, we don't want to look at the facts because that might charge up the Trumpers more. Absolutely the opposite, I think, is the truth. Thank you.
Transparency.
Can I add one thing there?
Yes, Ray, please.
Yeah, I think we are all on the same side here, but we're debating two different things. And I think you're both right. I think that facts matter and that we should pursue audits and transparency and truth. And that's in one arena. When you're dealing with what we're dealing with here on the ground, though, in Georgia, as an example, and you'll see it other places, they will do what Arthur talked about. We had to oppose all aspects of all of the bills that were being presented. And the reason being is that, let's say that my friends that are in the Divine Nine, which are the Black fraternities and sororities, went in and said, well, yeah, we're for verification of voter IDs. Then the Republicans will use that and say, hey, we got the Black fraternities and sororities supporting provisions in the bill. So we got bipartisan support, which then puts our friends who are trying to deal with the most onerous parts of this and take them out. And that response is going to dramatically undercut people who are trying to help us out the most. So I think you can go down the road of transparency and audit and not be afraid of that. But remember, when you're in the battle and the strategic battle over legislation, that is not where you're going to be able to use the facts matter fight, because you're dealing with a group of folks who are all involved in the big lie that is the principle behind the entire means of legislation. We had, you know, as everybody says, Biden won Georgia three times. So why are we having all of these bills put forward when it's been demonstrated that it was 0.0019 or some crazy number of any problems? So that's what we have to recognize, that some people are doing this for a totally different reason when it comes to the legislation we're fighting.
Just to let you know, I'll be posting some very informative links about how the conspiracy mongering works on people's minds, how it's affecting our debate. I've aggregated it. Take a look at it. It'll help you understand the reality we are in now, as opposed to normal policy debates. It's a completely different world.
Yeah, I do want to point out that Donald Trump, with a straight face at CPAC, said that he called out 10,000 National Guard to protect the Capitol, but Nancy Pelosi vetoed it. I mean, that's the level of big lie thinking that we're at. Julie? And then I'd like to talk to Christian.
No, that was an old hand raise, sorry.
What's that, Julie? I'm missing you there. Christian Nunez, I wanted to check in and hear what's happening with NOW, and if you're using your great organization on these issues.
Sure, Christian? Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, please.
Perfect, great. I'm really enjoying this conversation tonight. I think it's really bringing up a lot of key issues for a lot of us that we're dealing with. You know, now we are still working, we're starting to get prepared for the 2022 midterm elections, understanding that it's going to be a fight, understanding everything I think everyone said about, you know, dealing with the battleground states, dealing with the voter suppression laws that have come out with many of the states. There is a lot of work that we are going to have to do organizing, and luckily we have so many chapters, and we're going to utilize our chapters in all of our states and local chapters to really help us push out messaging that we're trying to all convey here today. But I think one of the most important things I'm hearing is, I think what we all need to do is really work on our education to our voters and constituents, and I think really explaining it to them in ways that they understand. You know, for us, we want maybe to know so much of the metrics and so much of the data and, you know, and what's behind the voter. But for people who are out there who are being who are facing these issues and are experiencing these hardships and experiencing these suppressions right on. It's a different feel. So I think we have to make sure whatever work we're doing, we are relating to them and making sure that we are resourcing, providing resources. We're calling local, state, federal senators, and just making sure that we are advocating for them and their needs. I think that's where we have to do a lot of our work.
So is now plugged in with Ray and the work in the NAACP?
Yeah, Ray and I, we keep in touch. Ray and I have a meeting tomorrow with the rest of a group of people working to on these issues. So, and we'll continue to be there, support NAACP and other coalition partnerships that are really trying to do this work. You know, this Georgia bill, I mean, this is crazy what we're just hearing, you know, and we know that part of voter suppression is really wrapped with racial injustice and systematic racism. And that's what we're seeing in this voter suppression bill that's happening in Georgia right now. So it's really crucial that we look at, I mean, then we have to look at COVID still existing too. So what will this do for COVID? You know, with COVID going on, trying to put in these voter suppression where you don't have certain hours of the day, only certain populations can go. You're limiting the abilities for community orgs to get out and get the vote out. We have to really look at what this impact is going to do for everyone. And, you know, for now, of course, we are a women's organization, but women and children are directly impacted by a lot of these things that are happening. Women are some of the largest voting bloc that we're seeing. And so we need to make sure that we're all working together collaboratively to make sure we're motivating this change and getting these laws passed and to be passed.
Okay, great. So. All right, thank you, Christian.
Thank you.
I want to ask Art Levine and also Ray, is there anything new happening on DC statehood? How does DC statehood fit into the dynamic here with HR1? Okay, does anyone else have anything you want to add in? We've got 5 minutes, and we will have a kibitz after we turn off the recording. I just want to welcome Roberta Eidman. Roberta, you're in Los Angeles, and we're happy to have you on the call for the first time. I thought I heard someone trying to say something.
Yeah, Steve Kaiser, I'd like to make a comment about DC statehood
real quick. Yes, please, go ahead.
I think the original reason they didn't want the federal government to be seated in a state that it might give that state inordinate value and inordinate influence. So like with DC becoming a state, it would have the capital in their state. So that's the reason why they created the District of Columbia, and a lot of other countries around the world have created federalized districts for the capital city.
All right, that's interesting. I cannot resist, and I'm going to stick this in really quick. DC was created at a dinner party between Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison in 1790. And the reason it happened, and this is why there's a DC, is that the slave owners were coming to the Capitol in Philadelphia, and they were bringing their slaves. And the Quakers in Philadelphia were going to the slaves and talking them into running away. And the slave owners, like Jefferson and Madison, hated it. And so they wanted the Capitol moved to the South where there weren't any Quakers. And they went to Hamilton because Hamilton wanted the federal government to pay the debts of the states from the American Revolution. And literally, they had a dinner party, the three of them. And Hamilton had no respect for Jefferson or Madison. And Madison and Jefferson hated Hamilton, but they made that deal. And that's why the District of Columbia was established between Maryland and Virginia, because they had slavery down there and the Quakers weren't down there to talk the slaves into running away. That is the story of how DC was created. Okay, thank you everybody. Another incredible call. You guys are amazing. There are still 58 people with us. Anybody wants to stay in kibitz, you're more than welcome. If you wanna join me while I read a story to my granddaughter, it'll be about a little red bus going across town. She's 3 years old, quite sophisticated. And in the meantime, we'll see you again next week, same time, same place. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Harvey.
Pray for HR1 and pray for DC statehood, although I personally would prefer to see DC be a separate country, but that's a different argument. Okay, everybody.
We need them. We need them.
There's one lady who's waiting.
Thank you.
Andy is